Ja, vielen Dank für diese Einführung und ich möchte die Organisatoren auch danken für diese Einladung. Leider werde ich auf Deutsch, Englisch sprechen. Meine Frau, sie kommt aus Deutschland, sie ist meine Übersetzerin. Wir haben einen fantastischen Arbeitsaustausch. Ich korrigiere alle ihre englischen Schriften und sie übersetzt für mich. Aber leider sind wir beide ein bisschen überfordert im Moment. So, ich werde auf Englisch sprechen und mit Ihren Erlaubnis. So, this is part, in some ways, a kind of Zusammenfassung of the book that I'm writing on post-Marxism. And I found that the kind of Fragestellung for this conference really fit very nicely with my own sensibility, because one of the operations that I'm performing is reading Romanticism through the lens afforded by post-Marxism and more largely post-structuralism, and then trying to see the way in which Romanticism gives us something like a subterranean history of the concept of the symbolic as it is functioning in this recent radical democratic discourse. And I want to emphasize, I'm not arguing for straight lines of influence or a kind of direct genealogy, but rather in some ways resonances and reverberations between the kinds of problems that we find, especially in German Romanticism, and what emerges in post-Marxism. And part of what I'll be arguing is that it is customary when we think about the post-Marxist use of the concept of the symbolic to immediately insert them into the semiotic tradition opened by Saussure and carried on by structuralists and the kind of radical semiosis of post-structuralism. And what I want to emphasize is that, in fact, when figures like Ernesto Laclau, or I'm going to also speak about Slavoj Žižek, when they use the concept of the symbolic, they're in fact mobilizing a much richer and polyvalent tradition. In some ways, I'm going back to Peter Neeson's emphasis on productiva Unscharfheit. Okay, so Oliver Marschauer recently asserted in his important book on post-foundational political thought that contingency has become a sign of our age, part of our intellectual horizon, and the key operational term within the theoretical paradigm of post-foundationalism. If this is true, then the symbolic is surely an equally important operational term. Of course, contingency and the symbolic hang closely together, for in the 20th century, we grew accustomed to regarding the symbolic as arbitrary, an order that itself finds no foundation outside of itself. If we narrow the discussion of post-foundationalism to post-Marxism, then it is evident that the groundlessness of the symbolic order enables a key move, namely the abandonment of Marx's ontological assumption, that is, the belief that society is grounded upon the material foundation of economic life. If society is a symbolic construction without ground in an anterior natural or metaphysical order, then new imperatives and possibilities for conceptualizing political action emerge. At the same time, however, and this is the classic double bind in a sense, however, the idea of society as symbolic order threatens to pose new impasses insofar as the loss of foundation makes it seem impossible to find a position outside what Slavoj Žižek calls the gargantuan matrix of the symbolic order. This tension between, on the one hand, the possibility to escape from determinism and open the social space to creative political action, and on the other side, the symbolic order as a ubiquitous ideological grid that always already inhabits our subjectivity, will be familiar to anyone who has read Slavoj Žižek or Ernesto Laclau, the two figures I want to discuss today. When we think of Laclau and Zizek's engagement with the problem of the symbolic, we readily insert them into a genealogy that has its main orientation in France. This is, of course, a very complicated genealogy, reaching backwards from post-structuralists like Derrida, back through structuralists like Bach, Althusser, Lacan, and Levi-Strauss, to interwar figures like Bataille, to earlier thinkers like Mauss, Durkheim, and Saussure. Of course, it is a commonplace that Claude Lévi-Strauss was above all the key figure steering French thought toward a preoccupation with the symbolic, insofar as he built structural anthropology on the linguistic model pioneered by Saussure and then subsequently figures like Jacobson. Repeating Saussure's exclusion of the historical diachronic dimension of language in order to establish a synchronic science of language as a system, Lévi-Strauss defined the symbolic as a closed order of social representations that form a system, the function of which is to render the perception of the world coherent by superimposing on the continuum of reality a grid of taxonomic oppositions and syntagmatic associations. Likewise, Lévi-Strauss's new approach to cultural systems, in which what is important is not the figures or themes as such, for example, in the study of myth, but the system of their differences or reciprocal relations. And this is, of course, drawing heavily on Saussure's semiological principle, in which linguistic value emerges through differential relations among signs. This will be a familiar story for most of you. Likewise, it will be familiar to many of you that both Ernesto Laclau and Slavoj Žižek have been profoundly shaped not only by this high moment of structuralism, but much more importantly by the departure from that high moment in figures like Jacques Derrida with his critique of the structuralist concept of a centered structure, and Jacques Lacan's theorization of a conflict between the symbolic and the real. In different ways, both Derrida and the later Lacan deconstruct the structuralist idea of the symbolic as a self-sufficient closed order and instead describe a flawed symbolic shot through with that which it is not and cannot be. This move opens the terrain of post-Marxism, which develops a political theory of radical democracy from the paradox that society's ceaseless attempt to create an adequate symbolization of itself is itself propelled by the inherent impossibility of ever achieving such a symbolization. Despite the fact that this approach clearly differs from structuralism, when the term symbolic appears in post-Marxist discourse, we nevertheless immediately think of the structuralist definition of a system in which values emerge through differential relations among elements within that system. The structuralist definition of the symbolic thus continues to dominate our understanding of post-Marxism, even if that definition persists mainly ex negativo as that which post-Marxism overcomes, or at least tries to overcome. My goal in this paper is to contradict this customary orientation toward the 20th century history of the linguistic turn. Accordingly, my main assertion is that in order to understand the nature of the symbolic as used in post-Marxism, we must recover a much more polyvalent idea of symbolism. And this obligates us to recover the repressed legacy of romantic ideas about the symbol. In what follows, I will proceed through three steps. First, I want to lay out some of the key elements of romantic symbol theory. Second, I want to explain what I mean when I say that the legacy of romantic symbol theory has been repressed. And third, I want to indicate some ways in which this exercise in historical archaeology might help us to understand the theoretical projects of Laclau and Žižek. And here I want to try to understand them not only in terms of what they share, but even more importantly, in what has come to divide them, because of course, it's an open battle between these two at this point. And that's an interesting history in itself, which I've written about. the fact that in the late 80s, for example, Zizek saw his own project as really a strong alliance with Laclau and Mouffe, and by now these two camps have absolutely come to fistfights, rhetorically at least. Rhetorical fistfights, if we can, it's a romantic symbol. Numerous critics of the structuralist idea of the symbolic have emphasized the polyvalence of the concept of the symbolic. For example, Claude Lefort, in an early essay on Levi-Strauss, pitted Levi-Strauss's impulse to mathematize the symbolic order against the use of symbols within the unmasterable complexity of lived social experience. Vincent de Combe has argued that whereas structuralism attempts to reduce the symbolic to a singular meaning, symbolism is irreducibly duplicitous. On the one side, so de Combe argues, the strictly conventional sign, and on the other side, the motivated sign that evokes the unsayable. On one side, the algebraic, and on the other side, the sacred. In a similar vein, Jean-Joseph Gou maintains the equivocal oscillation between what he calls abstract operational symbolization and what he calls cryptophoric symbolization. And Gou writes, "There is no true symbolism that is not cryptophoric. The symbol is a visible substitute that replaces something hidden, something that is not presentable." Rudolf Schlögl, in the German context, has conceded recently, after an extended survey of recent discussion, he concedes that there is simply no unified theory of the symbolic. But here I would agree with the French commentator Daniel Fabre that far from being crippling, this lack of unity has created a fecund uncertainty, that is, a fertile indeterminacy that has enabled a considerable range of theoretical projects. The same fertile uncertainty applies to romantic thinking about the symbolic. It is necessary to say this because in 20th century critical discourse, romantic symbolism has itself been subjected to a reductionist process. Walter Benjamin, for example, valued Baroque allegory precisely because its reliance on arbitrary conventions accentuated the gap between meaning and being. Romantic symbolism, by contrast, so Benjamin argued, rested on a dream of fusion and identity, whereby the gap between signifier and signified is allegedly transcended by what Benjamin calls, and I quote, "the idea of the unlimited immanence of the moral world in the world of beauty," close quote. Likewise, Paul de Man contrasted romantic symbolism to the deconstructive ideal of a literary writing that resists closure and the illusion of presence. Indeed, modernity, or more precisely, postmodernity, has sometimes been seen as intrinsically allegorical, insofar as it has forever foreclosed on the fantasy of immediacy, presence, identity, and transcendence. Insofar as such 20th century approaches distinguish strongly between allegory and romantic symbolism, they are not without some grounding in romanticism itself. Hence, the young Friedrich Schelling articulated a dialectical triad with the symbol standing at the top, serving to reconcile two opposed terms, schematism, schematismus, which, following Kant's terminology, signifies the particular through the general, and allegory, which signifies the general through the particular. And so Schelling writes, "The synthesis of the two, in which the general does not signify the particular, nor does the particular signify the general, but in which the two are absolutely one, is the symbolic. As opposed to allegory, in this picture, the symbol creates a relationship of identity, not simply of signification, between the general and the particular. The symbol is what it signifies. It presents rather than represents." Thus, Schelling offers as an example Mary Magdalene, who, and I quote, "does not only signify repentance, but is living repentance itself." Yet if we look at another canonical formulation of the new romantic theory of the symbol, we immediately encounter polyvalence and indeterminacy. I quote from Goethe, and some of you Germans will wonder why I'm calling him a romantic, but there it is. Goethe wrote in 1797, quote, "True symbolism is where the particular represents the more general, not as a dream or a shadow, but as a living momentary revelation of the inscrutable." Goethe contrasted this starkly to allegory, which he wrote, and I quote, "changes the phenomenon into a concept, the concept into an image, in such a way that the concept is always limited and complete in the image and expressed in the image." Unlike the allegorical, the symbolic, and again I quote Goethe, "the symbolic changes the phenomenon into an idea, the idea into an image, such that the idea remains always infinitely active and unapproachable in the image, and will remain inexpressible even if expressed in all languages." Close quote. Goethe's definition vacillates between an ideal of the symbol as a form of presence, or better, presentification, Vergegenwärtigung, and as a figure that initiates a disruptive, open, and above all, inexhaustible dialectic. Recognition of this side of romantic symbol theory has not been entirely absent in recent scholarship, and I'm building on that scholarship. Scholarship especially focused on the Frühromantik. Indeed, we even have attempts to link the Jena Romantics to deconstruction with romantic irony foreshadowing différence, the arabesque corresponding to a postmodern concept of art as an infinitely incomplete, open-ended process, and what Rüdiger Gerner has suggestively called the romantic pluralectic, which anticipates for him post-structuralism's critique of Hegelian dialectic. Yet again, it is important not to elevate one dimension of romantic symbol theory over the polyvalence that lies at its core. In other words, we shouldn't rescue the romantics now and turn them into postmodernists. It's polyvalent, and that is to say, it's the symbol is simultaneously a figure that concentrates and disperses meaning. It is a powerful figure, not just one sign among others, but one that has the paradoxical power both to present or body forth and to accentuate the gap between sign and signified. It is with good reason that Umberto Eco once asked whether the romantic symbol is an instance of immanence or of transcendence, and then Eco leaves the question fully unanswered. The polyvalence is further accentuated when we consider that the same romantics who distinguished between symbol and allegory often used the terms interchangeably and collapsed the two into a general idea that the modern age is itself allegorical. So we're encountering that postmodern idea already in the romantics. That is, modernity is a state of longing for an impossible unity. This understanding of modernity bridges the divide between the early romanticism of the Jena group, which recent scholarship has declared salonfähig, and later romanticism, whose Christian and politically conservative impulses continue to make it suspect. Thus, already in his conservative phase, in 1810, August Wilhelm von Schlegel could equate modernity with Christianity as a structure of desire in which we moderns hover between recollection and hope. In this view, the allegorical sensibility expresses, and I quote, "the distinct consciousness that the happiness after which we are here striving is unattainable, that no external object can ever entirely fill our souls, and that every earthly enjoyment is but a fleeting and momentary illusion." Likewise, in the late 1790s, so back into the radical phase of Jena Romanticism, during the full flush of that early and very experimental phase, Friedrich Schlegel could assert, "all beauty is allegory. One can only express the highest allegorically precisely because it is inexpressible." The Romantics did not doubt that there is a highest, a totality toward which the self should strive, that it remains mysterious and elusive, does not undermine the dream of reaching it. Indeed, precisely this dynamic interchange between possibility and impossibility seems to underpin the romantic sense of the moral grandeur of their own striving spirit, what Friedrich Schlegel called the unformed colossalness of the moderns. No necessary political direction attached to this symbolic sensibility. And here I'd just like to say, in some ways I want to make the same point that Laclau made in A Critique of Derrida's Spectres of Marx, where he says, there is no necessary political direction in deconstruction. It's a hegemonic move that is made. I want to emphasize the same about this romantic symbolic sensibility. Without question, it lent itself to conservative political thought. Characteristically, this actually took the form of trying to anchor down that interpretive dialectic and to find stable symbolic systems or orders. So, for example, Friedrich Schlegel's scandalous conversion in 1809, or the later Romantics' frequent turn toward Catholicism, medievalism, monarchy, nation, and originary myth. But there could also be more nuanced conservative strategies coming out of this symbolic sensibility. So, for example, jumping over to England, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who of course was the English Romantic who really did read the Germans, Samuel Taylor Coleridge defends the ancient constitution of England not by simply reasserting the power of tradition, as Edmund Burke had done, nor by defending its obscurity against Tom Paine's demand for perfect transparency, but by emphasizing that the idea behind the Constitution remains inexhaustible in relation to the form it might take at any historical moment. Here I quote from Coleridge scholar David Aaron Kaiser. Coleridge's account of the inexhaustibility of the English Constitution is an expression in Romantic political theory of a hermeneutical model well known in Romantic aesthetic theory, that of the symbol. These conservative strategies must be countered by progressive and even radical romantic uses of the symbolic. So, for example, Friedrich Schlegel's 1795 essay on republicanism challenges Kant's insistence that a republic cannot be democratic because a democratic republic lacks a clear separation of executive and legislative powers. Insisting that a republic must be democratic, Schlegel nonetheless recognizes the danger of coercion coming precisely through this lack of differentiation between spheres of power. His solution mobilizes a symbolic logic that uses Kantian categories against Kant. And here I quote, how is republicanism possible? The general will is its necessary condition, but the absolute general, and therefore absolute enduring will, does not occur in the realm of experience and exists only in the world of pure thought. The individual and universal are therefore separated from one another by an infinite gulf over which one can jump only by a salto mortale. There is no solution here other than, by means of a fiction, to regard an empirical will as the surrogate of the a priori absolute general will. Since a pure resolution of the political problem is impossible, we have to content ourselves with the approximation to this practical X. And obviously there's a Kantian language here of approximating a regulative ideal, but I also think that this emphasis on a fiction which allows us to place an empirical will in the place of that absolute general will is a somewhat different move. I think it's the romantic move in this rereading of Kant. In my own research, the essay on Pierre Leroux that was mentioned earlier, I have found that this figure, Pierre Leroux, romantic socialist of the 1830s and 40s, transferred the poetic description of what he called the style symbolique, the symbolic style, over into political thought. And it's interesting because Leroux was, in the 1820s, he was a liberal. He was briefly a Saint-Simonian, and then he became troubled by what he saw as the excessive collectivism of Saint-Simonianism. So in some ways, his political thought in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s is really, it's a kind of third way struggle already before we really knew that we had two ways. So he wants to find a third way between what he calls the socialisme absolu, the absolute socialism of the Saint-Simonians, and the individualité absolute of liberalism. The romantic notion that the symbol is a visible representation of the invisible connected LaRue's aesthetics and his politics, for the symbolic mode suggested a way to think of social relations without reifying them. The gap between representation and objects, such as individual, society, humanity, and God, seemed to open for LaRue a space for artistic and political creativity. And it's interesting, both Lefort and some of his students have taken an interest in LaRue and have recognized, in some ways, anticipations of some of the key moves of Lefort's work. Mention of the romantic merger of aesthetics and politics immediately calls to mind Walter Benjamin once again, namely Benjamin's critique of aestheticized politics. Within that critical context, the German romantics have been harshly criticized for their yearning for wholeness, their willingness to transfer the ideal of the harmonious fusion of form and content from the work of art to the realm of politics. Yet the image of romanticism I am presenting supports a different kind of aesthetic political philosophy suggested in an unjustly neglected book by Frank Ankersmit titled Aesthetic Politics, Political Philosophy Between Fact and Value, Beyond Fact and Value. Ankersmit bases his aesthetic politics not on the organic unity of the work of art, but on, and I quote, the insurmountable barrier between the represented and its representation. Ankersmit calls this an aesthetic of brokenness. From this position, he proceeds to describe a politics that is acutely aware of the irreducible non-identity of the representation, that is, the state, and the represented, that is, the democratic electorate. And I quote again, political reality, Ankersmit writes, is not something we come across as if it has always existed. It is not found or discovered, but made in and by procedures of political representation. The legacy of romantic ideas of the symbolic has been repressed. So I'm moving on to point number two. It may well be that these ideas have been victim of a general tendency whereby the engagement with the history of the symbolic typically involves some form of exit narrative. As Sven Lütiken recently wrote in the most recent New Left Review, he writes, in the end, all genealogies of the symbol seem to end in practices of radical de-symbolization. Indeed, one could see this as a basic premise of enlightenment. Myth yields to science. A world thick with opaque symbols evolves into a world of rationally transparent relations. Belief in the real power of symbols gives way to a recognition of their status as fictions. The power of symbols to present fades before the function of signs to represent. Certainly, Levi-Strauss's approach to the symbolic leaves no room for the polyvalence of Romanticism. Moreover, his approach, even though it emphasizes the symbolic, is a project of desymbolization. Modern science is gradually bringing signifiers into a closer relationship to the meanings that we are discovering as objective knowledge. Even more directly relevant to our discussion of post-Marxism, we see this dialectic of desymbolization at work in the history of the Marxist left. Karl Marx, of course, recognized the power of symbols, but his critical project was to dissolve the symbol by tracking it to its root. Consider what is probably the most important example, the commodity. The commodity is a symbol of value generated by labor. Value is a social relation that gets condensed into the commodity. Hence, wrote Marx, every product is a social hieroglyphic. It is no accident that Marx insisted that to find an analogy to this process, we must, and I quote, have recourse to the mist-enveloped regions of the religious world. And this, of course, is the basis of his idea of fetishism. Here, Marx's effort to decipher the social hieroglyph draws directly on the critical mode first formulated by the left Hegelian critique of religion. Marx ties the enlightened drive toward desymbolization directly to the epoch-making task of secularizing the world. Communism was to be the last act in the secularization of humanity. In light of Marx's critique of the commodity, it is not particularly surprising that the left Hegelians sharpened their blades for combat with Romanticism. Nor should it come as a surprise that the left Hegelians rigorously and vigorously attacked Romantic concepts of symbolic form. Just as the Romantic ideal of the symbol was anchored in the desire to present the unpresentable, so too was the left Hegelian rejection of the symbolic deeply implicated in their campaign against religion. Marx followed the left Hegelians in associating human emancipation with the task of overcoming the otherness, heteronomy, and unmasterability implied in symbolic form. In the period of Marxism's collapse, the intellectual left's suspicion of symbolic form has been eased. And with it, the dialectic of desymbolization has in certain ways been reversed. To be sure, if we turn back to Ernesto Laclau and Slavoj Žižek, it is clear that neither of them accepts at all the romantic belief that the symbol corresponds somehow to an ineffable outside, to what Novalis once called the numinous. For both Laclau and Žižek, symbols belong strictly to the human domain. They do not reveal an ontological correspondence between sign and world, but rather a specific human operation. At the same time as the post-Marxists thus share a disenchanted terrain with Marx and Levi-Strauss, nonetheless, the symbolic does work for them that requires us to recapture the polyvalent possibilities in the theory of the symbolic. To make this argument is not to claim some sort of direct influence of Romanticism. Rather, I am suggesting that in the present context, the polyvalence that I believe is intrinsic to all notions of the symbolic has reemerged from under a prohibition and has come to play a productive role in post-Marxist theory. My time is quickly running along, so let me provide an illustration, namely Laclau and Žižek's approach to universality, which of course has come up in a number of different contexts. It is a particularly good example because of the productive relationship between the impossibility of representation and the necessity of symbolization. Both Laclau and Žižek have argued vigorously that the left will be reinvented, only if it can move beyond postmodern identity politics and recapture the category of the universal. But of course, the universal is itself a profoundly problematic term for these thinkers. As Laclau writes, the universal is an empty but ineradicable place. The universal is the fullness of the social itself, yet that fullness itself can never be symbolized. Viewed through the Lacanian lens that is common to both Žižek and Laclau, this means that the social totality is itself the real, a void. This void reveals itself precisely by the retroactive failure of the symbolic in its attempt to name it. Writes Laclau, this emptiness itself, this negativity, produces a series of crucial effects in the structuration, destructuration of social relations. That is to say, social relations will be driven by the impossible desire to fill the empty place of the universal with positive content and the inevitable failure of every such attempt. If the system the totality, universality, as such cannot be represented, then particular signifiers must perform this function. In his work since the early 1990s, McLeod has pursued the consequences of this argument with particular rigor, building on the paradox of differential systems. If elements only gain identity within a system of differences, they nonetheless all share a certain equivalence insofar as they all stand on this side of an exclusionary limit. Exclusions, of course, are necessary in order to talk about a system at all. Each element is split between difference, which is important to the creation of value within the system, between difference and the equivalence which allows it to belong to the system. But far from hindering the operation of a system, this split is constitutive of any actually existing system. This description allows Laclau a means to reformulate the notion of equivalential links, and that, of course, is crucial to the theory of hegemony, to reformulate the notion of equivalential links that he and Chantal Mouffe have first articulated in 1985 in a way that now opens this issue of equivalentiality, equivalence, more fully to universality. Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, 1985, presents equivalences in terms of metonymic links within a system of differences, where the openness of the social world is itself the result of that system. And here is Laclau and Mouffe's description of that system, quote, the constant overflowing of every discourse by the infinitude of the field of discursivity. Now, it's interesting that their first reference in making that claim is, of course, Derrida, but they also support this idea of the overabundance of meaning through reference to Svetan Todorov's book, Theories of the Symbol, and especially the chapter on Romanticism. So you start to see, in fact, these connections emerging. Laclau's more recent idea of equivalence now orients itself to the system itself, or more precisely, to the empty place of that system. If universality cannot itself be represented, then a particular signifier will have to assume the function of representing the universal, of becoming what Laclau says will be a symbol of a missing fullness. Laclau and Zizek share many common grounds, yet in the last 10 years or so, they have grown increasingly distant, culminating in an open and, in certain ways, unseemly fight in the pages of the journal Critical Inquiry in 2006. The full range of issues that divide them is the subject of a chapter in a forthcoming book that I hope I'm completing, but these cannot concern us here. I want to just briefly in the final section of my talk, consider how our little foray into Romanticism might shed light on the differences that have come to divide Zizek and Laclau. One of Zizek's most recent books bears the title In Defense of Lost Causes. Its cover presents an image of the guillotine blade, symptomatically expressing Zizek's turn away from post-Marxist radical democratic thought and his embrace of the rhetoric of revolution, as well as the canon of revolutionaries from Robespierre through Marx to Lenin and Mao. Zizek's title immediately invites the word romantic. What could be more romantic than lost causes? What is more romantic than desperate acts driven by passions that burst through all constraints with such power that the world itself might be changed? To call Zizek such a romantic is to play with a readily available signifier that circulates freely in our culture, is usually negative, and is almost always devoid of reference to the historical phenomenon of Romanticism. If we apply a more strenuous definition, there are still some grounds for the designation. After all, Zizek returns repeatedly to the resources of German idealism in the Romantic Age, especially Hegel and Schelling. If the early Zizek archly insisted on naming Hegel the first post-Marxist, His 1996 book, The Indivisible Remainder, suggests that the later Friedrich Schelling, the Schelling of the positive philosophy, must also share this rank as post-Marxist before the letter. What if we consider Zizek from the more informed standpoint I've tried to develop in this paper? Here I would suggest that Zizek's revived enthusiasm for the idea of revolution and total transformation has led him to seize upon only one aspect of the polyvalent romantic idea of the symbol, namely the power to presentify or to make present. Let me illustrate this by brief reference to Zizek's critique of Derrida. In the 1990s, Zizek grew increasingly critical of the structure of infinite deferral that underpins Derrida's thought. Zizek's 2001 book, Did Somebody Say Totalitarianism, ties together two registers of the topos of infinite deferral. On the one side, Derrida's Democracy à venir, and on the other side, the Derridian Levinasian, and I quote, messianic longing for the otherness that is forever to come. This haunting specter, Zizek complains, and again I quote, can never be translated into a positive, fully present, existing entity. Messianic yearning precludes the act, forever remaining suspended in a melancholic, passive stupor. What a contrast to the good news of Christianity, Zizek tells us. Pre-Christian religions, he writes, either emphasize the inadequacy of all finite objects, and hence the need for moderation, that would be Stoicism, or the retreat from temporal reality in favor of the true divine object, in various forms of mystical contemplation. Christianity alone offers Christ as a, quote, mortal temporal individual, and insists that belief in the temporal event of incarnation is the only path to eternal truth and salvation. Close quote. The uniqueness of incarnation is thus the positive, fully present, existing entity that is precluded by the melancholic stupor of infinite messianic longing. This concrete presence thus creates the conditions for a genuine rupture, a conversion that can reorder reality and create a new symbolic order in which even our past can be retroactively re-symbolized. This emphasis on concrete presence, the power of incarnation, is tightly knitted or knotted together with Zizek's thinking about revolution. After all, as he writes in The Ticklish Subject from 1999, the true test of the revolutionary is, quote, the heroic readiness to endure the conversion of the subversive undermining of the existing system into the principle of a new positive order which gives body to this negativity, close quote. And here what I'm about to say resonates very fully with Lefort's emphasis on the empty place of power. Zizek, quite in contrast to Lefort, writes, and the authentic master in the revolutionary situation is he who is willing to occupy the untenable place of power and assume the impossible position of ultimate responsibility. The dynamic structure of impossibility that links Romanticism to post-Marxism is here pushed aside, at least rhetorically. Zizek's latest word is not demand the impossible, but rather the impossible does happen. Zizek thus departs from the polyvalence of Romanticism and lays a one-sided emphasis on the power of a figure to incarnate, present, and embody. He thus reenacts the short circuit implicit in the young Friedrich Schelling, whereby the symbol short circuits the gap between particular and universal, such that a figure like Mary Magdalene does not only signify repentance, but is living repentance itself. By contrast to Zizek, it is Laclau who is the heir of the subterranean legacy of romantic polyvalence. Let me conclude in this final paragraph with a very revealing moment in Zizek and Laclau's debate in the book Contingency, Hegemony, Universality, which was published in 2000. Early in the book, Zizek poses a series of rhetorical questions to Laclau. He writes, what if the political itself, the radically contingent struggle for hegemony, can be operative only insofar as it represses its radically contingent nature, insofar as it undergoes a minimum of naturalization? What if the essentialist lure is irreducible? Laclau returns to this point later in the text. Laclau acknowledges that Zizek does not really believe that any positive entity can truly fill the lack in the social. But he proceeds to make a very telling point. Laclau writes, in the endless play of substitutions that Zizek is describing, one possibility is omitted. That instead of the impossibility leading to a series of substitutions which attempt to supersede it, it leads to a symbolization of impossibility as such as a positive value. This point is important. I'm still quoting. Although positivization is unavoidable, nothing prevents this positivization from symbolizing impossibility as such, rather than concealing it through the illusion of taking us beyond it. The possibility of creating such a symbol, writes Laclau, is, and I quote, important for democratic politics, which involves the institutionalization of its own openness, and in that sense, the injunction to identify with its ultimate impossibility. In his 2006 exchange with Zizek, Laclau insists that the very definition of politics is the creation of symbols, and the highest of all symbols is impossibility as such, recognition of which is itself a basic imperative of post-Marxist radical democracy. This is a need that moves beyond the ubiquitous and orthodox late 20th century definition of the symbolic as a differential system. Laclau's symbol is not merely a sign, rather it mobilizes the polyvalence of the romantic symbol. That is, the radical democratic symbol must simultaneously body forth and present and expose the impossibility of ever establishing identity with the social totality. Or, to recall the words of Friedrich Schlegel, one can only express the highest allegorically precisely because it is inexpressible. Thank you.